gives me great pleasure to call on Patty O. from Dana Point.
Thank you. I'm Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober tonight and participating in my own recovery. I'd like to thank you for inviting me here. It's a privilege to stand here as an example of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the power of the 12 suggested had better steps to recovery, and the power of a gentle and loving God that works in my life. I didn't know I had a story before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that what I was doing out there before I came to you people was putting the story together. If I had known that, I'd have done some things a little bit differently. I'd have taken notes, because there's some areas that I have a hard time remembering exactly what the story was. If you're new tonight, I want to tell you, when I came here and I heard people talk about incomprehensible demoralization, and I heard folks talk about the degradation of the female alcoholic, I had no idea what that was. I thought things like wetting the bed were weak kidneys. Going to jail stark naked was my protest against police brutality. I had to stay here long enough to find out that those were the things that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous were referring to when they talked about incomprehensible demoralization. I'm supposed to share what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I was born in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. Now, that may not mean anything to you, but it's real important to me. I was born February 3rd, 1949, and the only reason that's important is because before then, everything was fine. Up until that day in my life, things were comfortable, and they were secure, and they were happy, joyous, and free. I believe my father abandoned us when I was born. I hadn't gotten home from the hospital yet, and being truly alcoholic, I accepted responsibility for that. I assumed guilt immediately. If I hadn't been born, my father wouldn't have left. And if my father hadn't left, he and my brother and my mother would have lived in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, and happily ever after in a white house with a white picket fence. I wish I could change that, but my mother wasn't going along with it, and there wasn't much I could do about it. My mother came to California when I was 4 years old, and she came here on vacation. She told my brother and I she'd bring us back a souvenir from California, and she did. She brought us home a new father. She was a little impulsive. She was only on a two-week vacation. What I learned about honesty, I learned from those two people. Their marriage was based on what I have always thought honesty was all about. You just tell the other person, you know, what you want them to know. My mother told my father that her father owned a grocery store in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, so he assumed that the family had money. My grandfather did own a grocery store in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. It went out to about the fifth row, and it was this one little section, and that's how big it was. And my father told my mother that he would take her to Acapulco on their honeymoon, so she assumed he had money. And they did go. An hour after they were married, they were in the Acapulco room in downtown L.A. And neither one of them had lied to each other. They had both told the truth, and those were the two people that I was to learn what honesty was all about. My mother brought him home, and he walked into our house, and I took one look at him, and I ran and hid underneath the bed. I knew that if that man took a look at me, he would see the same awful, terrible things that my own father had seen. And when he saw how bad I really was, he would leave too. And so I went at 4 years old. I went and hid underneath the bed, and I was content and willing to stay there for the rest of my life. Unfortunately, we moved to California, and when the moving truck came, they took the bed off from on top of me, and I didn't... And that day was the day I started losing my choices, and I didn't know it. Now, we came to California, and my parents told us that we were being raised with love, and I believed them. Any more of their love, and I'd have died. Their love was physically, mentally, and emotionally abusive, and that's what I learned love was. If you love somebody, you hurt them. And so I made a commitment at 4 years old that I would never love another human being. I was already guilty for being born. I could not stand putting that kind of pain on another person. And so it seemed a small price to pay to me to never love anybody, and I didn't. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never loved anybody. Now, I found out, having been here for a while, that if you use the words, I love you, and if they're properly timed, money, property, and prestige follow right behind, but I never knew that. I stole most of my money, property, and prestige, and the consequences never seemed as permanent. When I was 8, I had my mother and father were a little obsessive, besides being compulsive. By the time I was 8, there were 6 kids in my family. We were all sitting home one evening, family night, and we were watching television, and it was some big drama, one of those tear jerkers, you know, those things that you just start weeping uncontrollably. It was some real sad moment. Lassie had come home or something, and I was crying because Lassie had come home, and I heard this noise, and I turned and looked, and everybody in my family was laughing at me because I was crying because Lassie had come home. And so at 8 years old, I decided that I would never cry again. If I cried, then you would hurt me. If I showed any weakness, you would hurt me. It was through those weak areas that they and them and you were going to come get me. And so I made a decision at 8 years old that I would never cry again, and I didn't. It always amazes me how quickly I learned before coming here. I had one example, I had one lesson, and I learned forever. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you had to keep telling me the same things over and over and over and over before I got it. But when I was young, I was a quick learner. When I was, we were raised Catholic as much as that's possible, and never quite understood this part of my story, but I always like to share it in case somebody after the meeting can explain it to me. My mother was going to hell because she remarried so that my brother and I could have a father. And because of the fact that she was going to hell for remarrying, my brother and I had to go to confession every Saturday afternoon. And we never knew why, but we did it. You know, every Saturday, Michael and I would go, you know, prancing off to church. And I wasn't into any real heavy sinning yet at 12 years old. I hadn't done any real big deal things. And so every Saturday, I'd go there and I'd tell the priest the same lie, or the same sin. Well, that was one of the biggest ones. The same sin, Saturday after Saturday after Saturday. And I knew the man was getting real bored with the whole thing. I'd go in and he'd yawn and he'd make, you know, noises all during my little confession that he was not... You know, it wasn't the highlight of his afternoon, that was for sure. So one Saturday when I was 12 years old, I decided what I would do was I would put a spark in this man's afternoon. I like to call it creative confession. I spent several days planning, taking notes, writing things down, and I was off to church that Saturday with the most creative confession I could come up with. And I went into the confessional and I did my confession. And it did put a spark in the priest's afternoon. He was breathing hard by the time I got done. He had gasped a few times. I felt good. I walked out of there. Now, if I had continued doing the penance he had given me, I would still be going to daily mass twice a day and saying 6 rosaries every day. But that seemed okay, too. You know, I had this little spark of humanity, this little compassion. And I had done something for another human being. And I really felt good about it. Now, I'm almost embarrassed to tell you, but I'm 32 years old, and I still haven't done some of the things I told that man. My sponsor guarantees me that if I stay sober long enough, I may have an opportunity. Anyway, I felt good all the way till the next morning, all the way till Sunday morning after Mass when this whole family of ours was standing out in front of the church. And if you're a good Catholic family, after church you hang out in front of the church so everybody can see you there. And we were hanging out in front of the church this Sunday morning, and the priest came up to my father, and he had said Mass, and when he got done saying Mass, he came out to the front of the church, and he told my father the things I had told him in the confessional the day before. And my father took me home and beat me, and that was okay. That meant he loved me. And I learned from that experience, though, never to trust another human being, that if I told you anything about me, you would use it against me. Anything you knew about me, someday you would turn around and use to hurt me. And so I start, you know, and what I was doing, and I didn't know it, what I was doing was I was shutting down. I was building walls to keep you out, and the walls were getting bigger, and they were getting thicker, and they were getting higher, and you were staying out. And the thing that I never realized was while I was so busy keeping you out, I was also keeping me inside, and I had made myself a prisoner inside those walls. God was very gentle and very loving with me. He allowed me to find alcohol when I was 13 years old. I believe today that if I hadn't found alcohol, I would have had to blow my brains out. I could not have continued to live that way. When I was 13 years old, I went on a camping trip with a group of girls, and somehow I got a bottle of vodka, and I don't even remember where it came from. But I had the bottle of vodka, and it was in my pillowcase, and I remember being real excited about it. And we got into the tent that night to go to sleep, and I pulled out the vodka, and I asked if anybody wanted any of it. And nobody wanted any. And I didn't understand it. They explained to me the reason they didn't want it was because all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, so what? And I took the top off of it, and I drank about half the bottle, and I had no idea what alcohol was going to do to me or for me. I had no expectations. My father, I believe, is a practicing alcoholic, and he was practicing then. And what alcohol did for him was it made him disappear. He would drink, and then he would disappear, and he would be gone for a couple of weeks, and then he would reappear, and then he would disappear. And that's what it did for him, but I didn't really expect it was going to do that for me. I didn't really have any expectations. But after I drank half that bottle of vodka, and I looked around, I realized that it hadn't done anything. Everything was just the same as it had been before I drank it. So, and, you know, what else to do? I drank the other half of the bottle, and I looked around, and nothing was different, and nothing had changed, and everything was exactly the same as it had been, and I was a little disappointed. Frankly, maybe something should have happened. Maybe I thought my real father would come riding through that tent on a white horse, and he would scoop me up, and he would take me off, and things would be all right forever after. You know, I'm not sure what I wanted that alcohol to do, but it didn't do anything. And after about 15 minutes, the one character defect that I admitted to when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous reared its ugly head. I have weak kidneys. I have always had weak kidneys. God has not taken care of that part yet. I still have weak kidneys. And after about 15 minutes, I had to go to the bathroom. And we were camped at the beach south of San Onofre. And I got out of the tent, and I kind of shuffled down the beach to the little outhouse, and I was kicking sand. And I went in there, and thank God I wasn't modest in those days. I got into the little outhouse, went to the bathroom, got through, went to leave, and found out that I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move my eyelids. Nothing would work. And for the first time in my whole life, I knew what absolute overwhelming fear was all about. I had the most tremendous fear that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Later in my drinking, I learned that two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But I didn't know that then. I didn't have a lot of experience, and I didn't know that. And so I got all the energy that I could get from anywhere in my body. And I kind of got it all where it was kind of looked like it was working up to one spot. And when it all got where I thought it was all gathered together, I fell face forward off the toilet, out the door, and face down into the sand, and I started crawling back to that tent. Well, I know tonight that the whole problem was my attitude. I had a real crummy attitude about the whole thing. If I'd have had a decent attitude, I could have had this fantasy going that I was in the Marines, and I was crawling along the beachhead, and I was being dive-bombed, and I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude had been right, it could have been a lot of fun. Well, I realize there's a little difficulty in getting a good attitude going when your pants are down at your ankles. I had started to throw up, and I couldn't quite get through it or under it or around it or over it. Under those conditions, it's a little tough to have a good attitude. But somehow, and I hope it was by the grace of God because I'm not sure, somehow I got back to the tent. My pants got up to where they belonged, and I fell in and I passed out. When I came to in the morning, my eyes started to clear a little bit, and I noticed there was nobody in the tent with me. And then they cleared a little more, and I realized that I had thrown up all through the night, and I had hit the top of the tent, the sides of the tent. I hadn't missed one square inch of that, and I didn't want to be in there either, and I got the hell out. Fortunately, it was my parents' tent, so we just kind of folded it up, and I took it home and put it in the garage. And a couple weeks later, we had one of our big family camping trips, and that's what we did when my father reappeared. We had a big family camping trip, and we're going to start over and get the family together. Well, I don't remember what was going on, but it was something real important, and I couldn't go on that family camping trip. And they took that tent, and they went camping, and they came back. They didn't say a word to me about it, and that's the way my family was, and that's the way my family is, and I assume that's the way my family always will be. If I do anything that upsets you, you don't tell me about it. If I do anything that makes you happy, you don't tell me about it. We had all these folks living in one house, and nobody ever talked to each other. I do remember they bought another tent right after that. And that was my first drink, and I loved it. It was the most wonderful thing I had ever done. It was the most joyous experience I ever had. It was something that I couldn't imagine how I'd live that long without doing. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body every day after that. Now, the stuff that I drank wasn't always what you classify as a beverage. I was sober 2 years before I trusted myself enough to gargle with mouthwash because I had drank mouthwash. I still buy perfume and spray bottles because I had drank perfume. I put anything into my body that had alcohol in it. And I did, some of that every day. And I always thought that I drank because I wanted to drink. I never knew that I had put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on, I had no choice. I always thought I drank because I wanted to drink. Now, I'd like to tell you that my drinking that I was a Kansas City housewife, and I sat on a couch, and I drank a little wine, and then one day I burnt the toast, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's not the way it was. I was responsible for setting a house on fire, and the house burnt to the ground, and I assumed there was a loaf of bread in there somewhere. So I did burn the toast, but I was still working on hitting my bottom at that time, and I didn't come here. I was a bar drinker, and I did all the things that women bar drinkers do. And I did a lot of the things that men bar drinkers do. I was never real particular about what I did and who I did it with, as long as I was drinking. I think we all have the same stories as far as drinking. I think we just maybe acted them out a little bit differently. I went to San Diego State, and I did well there, and I'm not sure why I did well there. I test well, I guess. I graduated with an extremely high grade point average, considering the things that I was doing. And after I had taken every class that San Diego State has to offer, because I'm one of those people that figures if you do something good, don't quit it. And I did school well, so why quit and go on and do something else? So I took every class that San Diego State had to offer, except for the men's physical education classes, and at that time they wouldn't let women take them. I understand they're letting women take those classes now. But I left San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. I had one friend who lived in Chico, California, and the only reason we were still friends was because she graduated from high school a year before I did, and I hadn't seen her since. We wrote at Christmas time and maybe once in between there, and she offered to have me move up to Chico when I graduated from college and start, you know, my life in the cruel, cold business world up there. And so that's what I decided to do. Now, I thought that was why I was leaving San Diego. I thought I was leaving San Diego because I had taken every class San Diego State had to offer. I did not think I was leaving San Diego because I had an assault charge pending. I had another drunk driving charge pending. My roommate was a little annoyed at me. Now, any of you folks that are married will probably understand this, and some of you that aren't married may understand it. It was always they and them. If they would have been consistent, I would have been okay. And I had this roommate who was not consistent. And if she had been consistent, I would have been okay. I was, that compassion thing that I had that Sunday afternoon when I did my creative confession, I still have that. And I would sit in the bar, and men alcoholics, or men bar drinkers, I guess they aren't all alcoholics, but the ones who drank in the places I drank in were certainly alcoholic. Men in bars are real boring, and the lines that they use are not creative at all. There are two standard lines. My wife doesn't understand, and I don't have any place to stay tonight. And the fellows that would be in the bars when I was in there, they'd come on with one of those lines, and this little compassion thing would start. And I'd say, listen, you can come home with me tonight, but I don't want to talk to you again until it's 2 o'clock and time to leave. And then when 2 o'clock would come, because I was basically an honest person, I would take the jerk home with me. And we would get to my house, and we'd walk in, and I'd point to the bedroom over here on the right, and I'd say, you go ahead and go on in there. I have to go to the bathroom. And so he would go into the bedroom on the right, and I would go into my bedroom over here on the left. And now, I had sent him in with my roommate. And sometimes that was okay. Sometimes that was just no problem at all. Other times, she would get real annoyed with me, and there would be this screaming and banging on my bedroom door. And for God's sake, I had 7 o'clock classes. Didn't they understand I needed to get to sleep so I could get up for my classes? Well, you know, she had been consistent. If it would have always been all right or never been all right, I would have been okay, but her inconsistency. And I didn't think the fact that she was annoyed with me and had left all of my worldly possessions on the porch, and there weren't a lot, they were about this big and about this high, and I tucked them away in the corner of my car, I didn't think that had any reason why I was leaving. There was a woman in San Diego, and I hope and I pray that she found Al-Anon. There was a woman in San Diego that wanted to kill me. And I didn't understand it. And I hope she's found Al-Anon and has released me. And but this fellow in a bar one night, you know, didn't have any way to get home. Well, I don't know about you folks, but I could always drive better after I'd had a few. And he was, you know, he was too drunk to drive, and so I gave him a ride home. And I got him to his house, and he invited me in for a drink. Well, I can't be rude. So I went in to have a drink with him. Well, I should have known when we first got in. He said, now, you have to be very quiet. Well, I just figured he had a roommate like mine. I understood that. So we went in very quietly, and he fixed the drinks, and we went down the hall into this bedroom. Well, my second clue was that there were two single beds on the opposite sides of the room. But he really got those together fast, and I hardly noticed, you know, the thing there. And we started drinking our drinks and fooling around, and one thing led to another. And before I knew it, I had to go to the bathroom. So I got up and went in and went to the bathroom. And then I was ready to play. And I came down the hall, and I got to the bedroom door. And I went running across the bedroom. I did this Tarzan yell as I leaped into the air and leaped into bed. And the minute I hit the bed, this woman started screaming. And there I was in bed with his wife. And I'm stark naked trying to get out of bed. And all of a sudden, he's at the bedroom door, and he's stark naked, and he's trying to explain to her that I'm his cousin. He hasn't seen me for 10 years. And we're trying to get reacquainted. You know, and she wasn't buying any of it. And I got out of there, and I, you know, and this lady was looking for me to kill me. And, you know, and if you're here tonight, hi. I didn't think any of that stuff had anything to do with why I was leaving San Diego. I thought I was leaving because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer, and I was off to Chico to start my life in the cruel, cold business world. So I already had all my personal possessions in my car, and I got a case of beer and 2 bottles of booze, and I started out for Northern California. And I drove up the 5 freeway, and I got 60 miles north of San Diego to Santa Ana, and I was out of booze. And I was thirsty. So I pulled off the first street off ramp, and I have like the 6th sense. It takes me right straight to the sleaziest bar anywhere. And I went into the parking lot of this bar just to get a drink because I was thirsty and I was out of booze. And I walked in, and Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox. There was a lot of smoke in the room. It had that really wonderful smell that sleazy bars have. There was sawdust on the floor. Somebody had thrown up several weeks before that, and they hadn't cleaned it up yet. And I knew I was home. You know, I sat down at the bar. I ordered a drink. I started chatting with this fellow, and he offered me a job, and I took it. I lived in my car for 2 weeks so I could find a place to live. And that's as far as I got, 60 miles. 60 miles from where I started from was as far as I got, and I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I did not know that I had no choice. I had, in Southern California, those of you who haven't been there much, we don't have a lot of trees. And when we do see one, it tends to scare us. And I was driving down the road one night, and all of a sudden there was a tree, and I ran right into it, you know, and it had like a little brick planter around it, and that protects the trees from people like me who don't see them very often and get real excited. And I ran into this brick planter, and I crumpled my car, and it looked like a little accordion. And being safety conscious and not wanting anybody to tempt anybody, I turned the engine off and locked the car, you know, and it was about this big by then, and a little accordion. And I was bleeding pretty badly, but I thought I had a bloody nose. So I walked. I was working at that time in the hospital doing public relations. And I was about 2 blocks from this hospital, so I just strolled on up there and walked into the emergency room. And thank God, a friend of mine was the admitting clerk in emergency that night, because I walked in and asked her if she could help me. And she went into a total panic and started screaming and yelling. And these little doctor people came running out and grabbed me, took me into the emergency room, laid me down. And then it was time for, if anybody here is in the medical profession, it was the time where you change your shift. And the shift coming on didn't want to start with me. And because they weren't on the clock yet, and the shift going off didn't want to start with me because they might have to stay overtime. So they just kind of pulled the curtain around me and left me there till it was, you know, the proper time to be treated. Thank God this lady was a friend of mine because she came back to talk to me. Now, she wouldn't open the curtain and look at me, but she was outside the curtain talking. And I stopped talking, and she knew something was wrong. And she peeked in, and I had bit my tongue, and that was where the blood was coming from. And when they laid me down, the blood started going down my throat, and I was drowning on my own blood. And she did another little panic scene, and they came running back, and fortunately, it was blacked out. They stuck something down me so that I wouldn't drown. They put 140 stitches in my tongue, trying to save it. They admitted me into the hospital. They hooked me up on IVs because I couldn't swallow my own saliva. They put IVs in me to give me nourishment. They had IVs in me to give me liquid so I wouldn't dehydrate, and they had IVs in me to give me medication because I couldn't swallow my own saliva. Well, the minute they got me all decked out in these little needles and they left the room, I unhooked all my IVs. I got out of bed. Now, I don't know why in hospitals they charge you such a horrendous amount of money when all they can afford to give you is the front of a gown. But in the front of that gown with that thing on, I left my room and I walked down the hall into the lobby, into the doctor's dining room where there was a fully supplied bar, which I knew well. And I walked in there and I got a couple bottles of booze, took them back to my room, rang for the nurse, and was very indignant because my IVs had fallen out. So she hooked me back up and she left. And as soon as she left, I took a teaspoon. I took one of those bottles of booze and I poured a teaspoon of booze. I put it as far back in my throat as I possibly could without gagging. And I tipped it over and I let it run down my throat. Now, I couldn't swallow my own saliva, but I managed to get alcohol into this body. And I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. I didn't know that at 13 years old I had put alcohol into an alcoholic body and I no longer had a choice. I was in that hospital for 15 days and I was in fine shape. I had to make several trips back to the doctor's dining room. They finally unhooked the IVs and they didn't save my tongue and they told me I would never talk again. Well, that shows you what the medical profession knows. And I didn't know that I had a problem with alcohol. I had absolutely no idea. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of one more drunk driving. The sheriff in Orange County has absolutely no sense of humor. I had taken their drunk driving test a number of times. I knew them well. I could take the test one step ahead of wherever the arresting officer wanted me to be. And I always learned from my past mistake, you know, what to do the next time on the next drunk driving test. And I always thought that was very clever. I always thought if you learn from your mistakes, they were okay to make. And so this night, they had me pulled off the side of the road, and I was doing their test, and I was doing real well. I had given myself an A+. In fact, I think I did several times tell him that I was doing A+ on his test. And then he said to me, he said, "Pat, we want you to say the ABCs backwards." Well, now see, the time before when I got stopped for drunk driving, and they got to that part of the test, I said, "Well, I can't even do that sober." Well, then they have you. See, that's what they're looking for. So I learned from that. So when he said, "Pat, I want you to say the ABCs backwards," I said, "Okay, fine." And I turned around. And I said, "A, B, C, D." And while I was turned around, they slapped the handcuffs on me. They put me in the car and they took me to Orange County Jail. And absolutely no sense of humor at all. And they put me in a cell with criminals. And for God's sake, didn't they know who I was? Didn't they know who I was to put me in that cell with those criminals? And I decided in that holding cell in Orange County Jail to get a prison break going. And I don't know where the idea came from because I didn't watch a lot of TV. But I explained to these criminal women what we would do. I said, "Now what we're going to do is we're going to take our coffee cups and we're going to bang them like hell on the bars. And we're going to get a lot of noise going. And when the noise gets real intense, the marshal is going to come running around here, and I'm going to throw my arm out the bars, I'm going to get her around the neck, I'm going to get her keys, I'm going to get this door open, and we're going to get out of here." And all these criminal ladies looked at me, and they said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" Well, little did I know how much I was going to hear that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I thought, "Okay, you criminals stay here. I'm getting out." And I got my coffee cup, and I was going like crazy on those bars. Well, there's a couple of problems. A styrofoam cup doesn't make a lot of noise. And when you're going on the bars, it tends to eat up the styrofoam cup. And when you get to your fingernails, it gets painful. And when it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And I was, you know, just stayed there. Well, they let me out of jail that time on an OR. And I hadn't been released from jail on an OR in a very long time. And they gave me one phone call and told me to call a friend to come pick me up. Now, I'm not proud as I stand here and tell you I didn't have a friend to come pick me up. There was absolutely nobody out there who I could call a friend to call and ask and come pick me up. There was one lady who had worked for me at one time, and I figured she owed me something because I had signed her paycheck for a number of months, and I figured I had supported her and her family for a long time. And I figured she owed me something, and I called her and I asked her to come pick me up from Orange County Jail. And she came and picked me up, and she took me back to my car, and while I was getting out of her car, she looked at me, and she said, "Pat, I don't ever want to see you again. I don't want to hear anything about you. I don't want to know where you are or what you're doing. As far as I'm concerned, you simply don't exist, and I'd prefer it if you keep it that way." And that lady wasn't even a friend. She was somebody that I had known. And I got out of her car, and my attitude was, "So what? Who needs you?" I was always one of those people that didn't need anybody. If it needed getting done, then I did it. And if I couldn't do it, then it didn't need to get done. And I got in my car with that arrogant attitude, and I drove away, and I did the only thing that an alcoholic knows how to do. I went to the bar, and I drank. I'm happy to tell you that that lady is a very good friend of mine today. She invites me to her home for dinner, and we sit together, and we laugh, and we talk, and I'm welcome there anytime. And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous and you people. I went to court for that drunk driving, and I knew how to do court. You know, you take a few shots before you go in. You hope the judge got some the night before. And you go to court. And you know, I had a son as a direct result of my alcoholism, and my son was 8 months old at that time. And I didn't like this kid at all. He couldn't do anything. He would not go get a job. I had gotten to a place in my life where I had to drink till about 4 a.m. And sometime close to 4 a.m, I could pass out. And then at 6 a.m, I came to, and I came to fast. I was always late. I never knew what I was late for, but I was always late, and I would come to quickly. Now, coming to quickly is okay if you're in bed. It's not too bad if you're on the floor. It's a little painful if you're in the back seat of your car. And it is very painful if you're sleeping underneath your car. And for some reason, I slept underneath my car a lot. I don't know if I needed the security or what it was, but for some reason, I came to a lot underneath my car, and I came to quickly. And I never learned from that pain. I never learned not to, underneath the car was not a place to sleep. And I would come to at 6 a.m, and wherever I was, I would get back home if I wasn't home. And I would get this kid of mine up, and I would change him, and I'd fix a bottle for him, and I'd dress him, and I'd put him in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch him. And I'd take him with me down to the bar, and I'd put him on the pool table. And he sat there from 6 a.m. until his godmother came and picked him up at 6:00 p.m. And in that time, I don't know if he was ever fed. I don't know if his diapers were ever changed during that time. And I'm not proud of that, but that's the way it was. And I stood in the court that morning, and I had absolutely no use for this 8-month-old kid of mine. And I had never wanted to be a mother in the first place. Well, I found out that is inadequate birth control. And so I had him. And the judge, you know where he sits way up there? And they're all dressed in black. And they look down at you, and no matter what they say, it's important because of where they're sitting and what they have on. And that judge threatened me that day. He threatened to take my license away and make me pay a fine and put me in jail for a year. And I thought I got to pick one of those. And I picked, I told him, I said, "Well, you could probably take my driver's license because I could drive without it. It'd be a little bit of a pain in the neck to cash a check, but other than that, it'd probably be okay." And he said, "Pat, you don't understand. It's not one of the above. It's all of the above." I knew how to do jail. I do jail well. I have done jail a number of times. There are more drugs and alcohol inside of jails than there are on the streets someday if you know what to do and who to do it to and you're willing to go to any length. The first place I ever put a needle in my arm was inside of a jail. I know how to do jail and I know how to survive there. That day, for some reason, at 26 years old, when that judge was threatening to put me in jail for a year, I knew that I could not survive jail one more time. I knew that if I went to jail one more time that I would never leave there. And I knew I couldn't survive. And so even though I didn't like this little kid that I had, I was willing to use him that day, and I said, well, Your Honor, you can't put me in jail because I'm a single parent and I have an 8-month-old baby. And that judge sat way up there, and he looked down at me, and he said, Pat, he said, we're going to put your son in a foster home because you're an unfit mother. Well, I knew I was a lot of things, and I would have admitted to being a lot of things, but I did not believe I was an unfit mother. I did not leave that kid with unqualified babysitters, and I didn't leave him in the car. You know, I had him with me inside that bar. At all, you know, from 6 in the morning till 6 in the night, he was with me, and I was not an unfit mother. And at that moment, I was willing to go to any length. And he offered me an alternative, and the alternative included meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I didn't know what you people were going to do to me or for me. It was the same as with alcohol. I had absolutely no idea what this thing A&A was all about. And I took it. I took it. I, you know, I would have stood on my head forever, you know, in this high of cow manure rather than go back to jail. And so I took the alternative and I came here. Now, I didn't come running and screaming the good news. I waited till the very last minute before I had to come to you people. I drank every drink that I could drink in the next 3 months. And I had gotten to a place in my drinking where I couldn't talk to you. I had to be in the bar drinking, but I could no longer talk to you. If you said hello to me, I was likely to break a bottle and cut you up. I was likely to break a bar stool over your head. I had to get physical if you said hello to me, because I knew by you saying hello that you were going to hurt me if I didn't hurt you first. And so I couldn't talk to you folks anymore for a very long time. And the Saturday night before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in the bar that I always drank in, and for some reason, the God that I understand today let me enjoy one more time. He let me have one more good time in those bars. For the first time in a long time, I laughed. I talked to the guys. We drank to Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever this was. We drank a lot to you people that night. And I had a good time, and I'm grateful that it ended that way. I had absolutely no idea that my last drink was my last drink. If it was, I'd have planned that a little differently, too. But I had no idea what was going to happen to me the next day when I came here, and I'm grateful it ended for me that way. I don't have to sit in Alcoholics Anonymous today and wonder, you know, if I could drink and laugh and have a good time, would it be okay? You know, I know tonight, sure as I'm standing here, that putting alcohol in this body under any conditions is not okay today for me. And then, that night at 4 in the morning, I did what I had done for a long time. It got close to 4 o'clock, and I said the only prayer I knew anymore. I said, Dear God, please don't let this be the day I wake up at 6 in the morning. Those 2 hours of relief were simply not enough anymore. And I didn't want to wake up at 6 o'clock. And that day, that Sunday, I woke up very gently at noon. And I hadn't woke up gently for a long time, and I hadn't been in bed till noon for a long time. And for one moment, I had a little bit of hope. One split second of hope, and then it went away. And for some reason that I didn't understand then, but I understand now, I didn't drink that day. I didn't put any alcohol into this body, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and there was a speaker's meeting in Laguna Niguel. Now, I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I just knew I didn't want one anywhere close to me. So I sat on an aisle chair. It was a speaker's meeting. I sat on the aisle, and I put my coffee and cigarettes on the chair next to me. Because whatever you people were, I didn't want you too close, and I figured I could keep you away that way. And I heard two things at that meeting. I heard that we don't drink between meetings. That made me a little nervous. I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol, but I knew I was going to have a problem filling up all those hours during the day. What do you do all day long if you don't drink? You know, that was what I thought the problem was filling up the time. And the other thing I heard was that the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. God knew I had to have the answers. Now, you can imagine how irritated I was when I got home and I couldn't find the questions. And my only thought was, Dear God, I've stolen the wrong book. And I was going to have to go back. And the court program that I was on, they wanted me to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was a little excessive. I immediately went out and bought a TV guide so I could figure out when the next available night was that I'd be able to come to one of these meetings. I didn't want to miss anything good on TV. I checked it all over very carefully. Now, the fact that I didn't own a TV never entered my head. I just simply didn't want to miss anything. And my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was on a Wednesday, and I didn't drink on Monday, and I didn't drink on Tuesday, and I didn't drink on Wednesday, and I didn't know why then. Today I know that my sobriety was a gift from a very loving and gentle God. I didn't know that then. And I hadn't drank for 3 days, 4 days when I went to my second meeting. I was a little nervous. Now, I didn't shake. I leaped. I would be on the end of my couch, and next thing I knew, I would be on the other end. And it was a long couch, and I couldn't figure out how I got there. And I would be sitting at the kitchen table in one chair, and then I would be in another one, and I didn't know how I got there. And I just figured you folks made me nervous. You people made me nervous. I hadn't been around people in a long time. You know, I hadn't... people made me nervous, and that's what my problem was. I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a meeting that's my home meeting today, and it's the best meeting anywhere, and I have been a lot of places in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that meeting, I stood outside, and the self-will of an alcoholic, I got every ounce of self-will I had gathered up in my body, and I walked in that room because I wasn't about to shake for you people. I wasn't about to sweat, and if I could have done anything about how I smelt, I would have done that too. Because I suspected that if I was in that meeting shaking, you would think I was an alcoholic. And I didn't want to give you any false illusions of what I was. I was simply an innocent person who had been stopped by a nasty highway patrolman one evening on my way home and not hurting anybody. And I didn't shake during that meeting. I sat for an hour and a half with full cups of coffee, and I didn't shake. And I got out to my car after that meeting. It took me 20 minutes to get my key in the ignition to get out of the parking lot. And the next day, I went to a man in Laguna Beach who had been at that meeting that Wednesday night. And this fellow, you got to picture this, and it's a little difficult to do. He was an older man. He sat with his legs crossed. He was real skinny. He had a bald head. He had those little tennis shoes on that don't have shoelaces, but they're supposed to. And he looked at me like he was nodding out during the meeting, and I figured, I want what he has. You know, you people are telling me that you're doing this thing without alcohol or drugs, and this guy, I want what he has, because you don't nod out on the Natch, you know. And so I went down to where he worked in Laguna Beach, and I went into his office, and I said, Dick, I said, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me that morning, and it must have been important to me because I remember the exact minute that he said it to me. It was 10:21 on a Thursday morning. And he said to me, he said, Pat, he said, if you don't drink, if you go to meeting, if you talk to other alcoholics, and if you read that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, I will guarantee you that you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, you won't go to jail and your life will get different. And for some reason, I believed him. I hadn't believed anybody in a very long time, but for some reason, I believed that man that morning. Now, I wish I could tell you that I ran home and did that real well and jumped into it and wanted to recover so bad I could hardly stand it, but I didn't do it that way. I had the book. I'd stolen it, so I might as well do something with it. I would read the first line in Chapter 3 where it says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics, and I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I went to as many meetings as I could. I went to two a week, which I thought was excessive. I started adding meetings at some time. Now, that should have given me some idea, but it didn't. I had some denial thing working about that. I started adding meetings, you know, one at a time, one a week. I didn't want you all to know I was going to more. But I just kind of started sneaking. I was a sneak meeting goer. I'd sneak into meetings. And I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach, and I'd get a cup of coffee. And Jim, who was the manager at that time, he would give me a cup of coffee, and I'd sit down, and I'd drink it. And then I'd be on my way out. I'd say, hi, Jim. And he'd say, hi, Pat. And that was talking to another alcoholic. And the only thing I did right was I didn't put alcohol into this alcoholic body. And I heard a man from a podium one night say that he knew he was an alcoholic when he heard his voice from his belly button while he was driving home late one night on a dark, windy road. He heard his voice tell him that he was an alcoholic. And I said, okay, God, if you want me to be an alcoholic, I want to hear my voice from my belly button. I figured if God did it for him, he'd do it for me. And I changed my lifestyle a little bit. I stopped driving on dark, windy roads. Didn't drive at night a whole lot, and I wore a lot of clothes. Because if I had ever heard my voice coming from anywhere, I would have gone off the side of the road and it'd have been bye-bye. And it didn't happen that way for me. The way it happened was that after my Wednesday night meeting and my home meeting, I was driving home, and I was just on my way home, it occurred to me that I was an alcoholic. And it was all right. And for another moment, I had a little bit of hope. And I got home and I called a woman on this program, and you folks were used to hearing from me, so you had made a few mistakes early on. You gave me your phone numbers and you told me to use them. So I did. I like to call you right about dinner time. I like to call married people right when I figured they'd be just going to bed. I particularly like to call about 3 or 4 in the morning. It was my, you know, favorite times. A lot of times I didn't say anything, I just breathed hard. And so this evening when I called Susie and I said, guess what? I can understand the hesitation in her voice when she said, what? And I said, I'm an alcoholic. And she started to laugh. And I knew she wasn't laughing at me, and I knew it was going to be all right. So you people had given me the dignity to come to that conclusion by myself. Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous told me I was an alcoholic. You didn't tell me I had to be an alcoholic. You gave me the dignity to find that out for myself. And I had been doing a lot of real bizarre things. I heard you people, you know, I heard you say things in meetings. You told me you were sick, and I believed you. And I was willing to stay here and help you get well. And you told me it was the first drink that got you drunk. And I thought, well, no wonder you want to quit. You know, if it was only one, if I could only have one drink and I'd be drunk, I would probably quit too and come here forever. I figured I was probably here to teach you how to drink. And you talked about things that I didn't understand. And you see, that really made me angry. And I thought it was anger. For a long time, I thought that what I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with was anger. I had to be here for a very long time before I understood that it was fear. And I couldn't tell you that I was afraid because I couldn't tell me that I was afraid. And so rather than tell either of us that I was afraid, I had to do things that made it look like anger. When you said something I didn't like, I either threw a cup of coffee at you or I tipped a table over, and you always said something I didn't like. And you didn't throw me out. You didn't tell me to go away. You told me that you smiled and you said, keep coming back. And then I knew besides being an alcoholic, you were a masochist. And I kept coming back, and I'm grateful that you treated me that way. Because see, for me, it took 8.5 months of not putting alcohol into this body before I could see what my relationship had been to alcohol. The evidence was piled this high and I couldn't see it. So I had blinders on and I couldn't see what was right there in front of me. And you gave me the dignity until my eyes cleared enough, until I had gone enough days without alcohol to look and see that evidence for myself and become an alcoholic. Now I'd like to tell you that I jumped into recovery and I skyrocketed to recovery and it's been wonderful ever since, and it wasn't that way either. Just because I was an alcoholic didn't make it any big deal. I still was not working those 12 steps of recovery. Those were for you folks. I didn't need to do those. You sick people probably needed to do them, but I didn't need to, and I was certain of that. After that Wednesday night that I became an alcoholic, I went back to Laguna Beach the next day to this man, Dick, and I told him, I went in and told him, I said, Dick, I said, this terrible thing happened. I said, now I'm an alcoholic. Now I have to stay sober, and I don't know how to do that. And he looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, Pat, if you go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and don't drink, he said, I'll guarantee you won't get drunk, and if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He did not tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my job life would get better, my sex life would get better. And I'm grateful because none of those things have gotten better. But they've all gotten different, you know, and that's what Dick promised me. And I hope as long as I'm sober, I don't forget to carry the message that he carried to me, because he passed away a few years ago, and it was a great loss for me. I felt a lot of anger when he passed away. I took it very personally. He was the only person that I believed and the only person that I would listen to when he died. And that just simply proved to me what I already knew, that was if I got close to you, you were going to leave me. If I got close to you, you would go away and I'd be left alone again. And it took me a long time to get through the anger of that. And I just hope as long as I stay sober, I remember to carry his message. I was sober almost a year. Well, I was sober a little over a year. And I was at the Canyon Club one day and I had... I was being very cocky and arrogant, which is what I do best. And a fellow came in, and he'd been sober for a couple of weeks, and then he drank that day. And he came into the club that evening, and I talked to him, and I don't know what I said. We talked for 45 minutes, and I don't remember what I said. He doesn't remember what was said. And after about 45 minutes, I had to go to the bathroom, and at least in sobriety, I know where to do that, and that's gross for me. I went to the bathroom, I came back, and he was gone. And I asked somebody where he went, and they said he was out in the parking lot, he was leaving. And I went out to the parking lot, and I asked him if he was okay. And he said, yeah, he was fine. He said, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to sleep, and I'll be back tomorrow. I said, well, I hope you're okay, because I love you. That was the first time in my whole life I'd ever said the words, I love you, to another human being. And I didn't know what they meant, but I knew what they felt like, and they felt good. You know, somewhere in here, they felt good, and I knew that it was going to be okay. And as he drove away, I stood in the parking lot, and I cried, and I hadn't cried since I was 8 years old. And standing there, I knew that line in chapter 5 where it says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. That line went through my head, and I knew that if I wanted to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to give myself completely to this simple program. And that meant that even I was going to have to work this 12 steps of recovery. I still yeah-butted, and I still fought. But when my back got against the wall, and I got down to a point where somebody would point their wiry alcoholic finger at me and say, do it or die, then I did it, because I didn't have a choice. They didn't give me a lot of choices. They simply said, do it or die. And I did it. And that's how I got through the 12 steps of recovery. And tonight I'm grateful that they did it that way. I'm grateful they didn't give me a lot of choices on all optional things to do. You know, if you don't want to do 4, why don't you skip? They didn't do it. They just simply said, do it or die. And I did it. And I'm grateful tonight for that. I'm grateful for the people that God put in my life. Because if he'd have put anybody else there, I may not be standing here tonight. And the God that I understand, you know, my job today is to go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink. And all the rest of it is God's business. I have absolutely nothing to do with all the rest of it. It's God's business. He's in charge of my character defects. There's some I wish he'd get, you know, busy on. He's in charge of those, and he's in charge of putting things in my life. And the things that God has put in my life in sobriety are absolutely impossible. Standing here tonight sober with you is absolutely impossible from where I came from. I came from a place where the only excuse I needed for drinking was if there had been a full sun that day and if I was awake. Those are the only two things I needed for drinking. For me to be standing here tonight sober is impossible from where I came from. I had the privilege in January to drive across country, and a friend of mine's company, and they don't even know me, they paid my airplane fare to Washington, D.C. and handed me keys to a 1981 Mercedes-Benz. And paid my expenses to drive it back to California. They didn't know that I used to steal cars. You know, nobody handed me keys to one and paid my expenses and, you know, they knew I was going to make it back to California. It absolutely amazed me. And I stopped at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous all the way across the country, and I found out that all the way across the country, they do it the same way we do. They go to meetings, they read the book, they talk to other alcoholics, and they don't drink, and they are sober all the way across the country. Absolutely floored me. I thought there was a secret. And there had to be something more, you know, a little, and that's the secret. And that's, I can live with that today. I had the privilege of stopping in Colorado on my trip and visiting a lady, a friend of mine who I love very much, and a lady who taught me a tremendous amount about love. And she had gotten sober in Laguna and then moved to Aspen, Colorado. And this lady taught me everything that I know about love. A year ago, April, I was at the Canyon Club and my son was injured. He fell into a trash bin and cut his head on a broken beer bottle, which probably tells me something about what his future is going to be like. And I was surrounded by sober alcoholics when that happened. I had people out there lighting cigarettes for me, handing me coffee. I'd have forgot that I smoked if they hadn't been there. And when they were going to let me take Patrick in my car to the hospital, and then something happened and I became very serious, and they called for an ambulance They put him in the ambulance and made me get in the cab, and we're going up the canyon road, and I very calmly asked the driver, why won't they let me back there with my son? The driver looked at me and matter-of-factly said, well, because your son may pass away and we don't know how you're going to react. Now, I wanted to know where was the bottle of scotch and where was the tequila, and I didn't want to get drunk, but they should have alcohol to give mothers for medicinal purposes when they give them information like that. And we got to the hospital, and I jumped out of the ambulance before it even stopped. And I got back to the back of the ambulance, and as they were opening the doors to take my son out of there, this lady was standing next to me, and she had her arm around me. And I knew it was going to be okay. You see, I was a little over 4 years sober, and I hadn't been able to let any of you touch me. I knew that if you touched me, you were going to hurt me. And when she put her arm around me that afternoon, I knew it was going to be okay. And I knew what love for an alcoholic to another alcoholic was all about, and I could feel it. And I knew that it was okay to let you touch me, that if you touched me, you weren't going to hurt me. And probably if I touched you, I wasn't going to hurt you either. And they sewed my son up, and he survived fine, and I survived fine. And both of us stayed sober through that experience. And I stopped to visit this lady, and I had an opportunity to give her back some of the things that she had given me. Because what happened to her was she got to a place in her sobriety where she forgot to take the tools with her when she moved. And I had an opportunity to hand her back some of the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God for giving me that privilege. I thank God for allowing me to be sober that day and carrying the message back to somebody who had carried it to me. And standing in a cabin in a kitchen in Aspen, Colorado on a Sunday morning, I called my son long distance. And I was a little over 5 years sober, and he was a little over 6 years old. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, he was 11 months old, and I brought him with me to you people. And you loved him, and you loved him, and you loved him, because I didn't know how. I had absolutely no idea how to love. And so you loved my son for me, and then you took me, and you loved me, and you loved me, and then you taught me how to love him. And that Sunday morning, I was able to call him here in California long distance. And for the first time in my life, I told him, I love you. And when I said those words to him, I knew I wasn't creating any of the conflict that I had felt inside of me when my parents told me that they were raising me with love. And the only reason that was possible was because of you people. And I was grateful. And I was so full of gratitude at that moment for you and for God and for this program of recovery. I left Colorado and I drove home on Highway 89 through Utah. I spent the night in Salinas, Utah. And people who know me well know that I had nothing to do with this. I woke up at 5 in the morning. I don't wake up at 5 in the morning. I don't know anything about 5 in the morning unless I haven't been to bed yet the night before. I woke up at 5 in the morning and I got in the car and I drove off without having a cup of coffee, and I don't do that either. I'm lethal out on the highway without some coffee in me in the morning. And I drove off down Interstate 89 and I drove and I drove, and it was absolutely gorgeous, and I drove and I drove. And I drove for 5 hours. Everything on that interstate was closed because it wasn't tourist season. All the little towns I went through, everything was boarded up. And after about 5 hours, I decided that I was hungry and I would like a cup of coffee. And just as I had that thought, I looked up and there was a cafe that was open. And I said, thank you, God. I thought, how nice of God to open a cafe for me right when I'm hungry and want a cup of coffee. And I walked in there and I sat down and I ordered my breakfast. And the man who was cooking my breakfast and who was also the waitress and the hospitality person and the only other human being in there besides me, he was cooking my breakfast, and I noticed on his cash register a little sticker that said, "We care." And when he came back and put my breakfast down in front of me, I asked him if he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, no. He said, I read an article about Alcoholics Anonymous 2.5 years ago. He said, the only meeting is 95 miles away and it only meets once a week, but I've never been there. He said, but I haven't had a drink of alcohol since that day. And that's a gift from a loving and gentle God. That's the gift of sobriety that we were all given. And I went out to the car and I got my big book and I got some tapes. And I went back in and he had his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I left my book and I left the tapes and I drove away. And I said, thank you, God, for allowing me to be sober today. For allowing me to carry your message to another alcoholic today. You know, and I was full of gratitude at that moment for you people and my God in this program of recovery. And when I got home, I sent him some tapes and some literature and some bumper stickers. And about a month later, I got a letter from him. And he had gone to that one meeting that was 95 miles from his house. And he met two men that lived 30 miles from his cafe. And those three men are having a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in his cafe on Thursday night. And I was grateful that I had been sober. And I was grateful that God let me carry that message. And I had an opportunity to feel a little bit of maybe what it was like in the beginning when Alcoholics Anonymous was new. And I was grateful. My son, who is, he'll be sober 7 years in November, and it irritates me. Have you ever lived with a 6-year-old who tells you the easy does it? He goes to meetings with me. He's got several meetings that are home meetings for him, and if he has to miss them for any reason, he gets absolutely crazy. He has learned a lot of things from people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He learned how to panhandle. He still won't go get a job. Maybe he won't have to. He's wanted to play soccer since he was 4 years old. And so when he was 4 years old and told me he wanted to play soccer, I said, okay, you can play soccer. Unfortunately, you're too young. And you'll have to wait a couple years. And I thought, what a good mother I am, telling my son he can play soccer. The fact that he's too young is, you know, hardly matters. And the next year he wanted to play soccer, and I said, sure, it'd be wonderful if you could play soccer, but you're too young, you'll have to wait a few years. This year, folks, when he told me he wanted to play soccer, he's old enough, and so I went and I signed him up, and that was a long time ago, and I kind of forgot about it. And I got a phone call from a woman who's the coach's wife, and she called to tell me about soccer practice. And I'm writing what she's telling me down, that soccer practice is Wednesday from 5:30 to 6:30, and Thursday from 5:30 to 6:30. And I'm writing it down, but in my head I'm saying, he's not going. I go to a woman's meeting at 6 o'clock on Thursday, and that's really too bad, but he's not playing soccer. But I'm writing it down. And then she tells me that he has to have soccer shoes, a soccer ball, and shin guards, and I'm writing it down, but I'm saying he's not going. I've been between jobs for a year. If you think that you can't stay sober without a job, you can. I have done it very successfully for a year. I have everything I've needed has been provided for me. God has put people in front of me that have asked me to do things and paid me just enough money to pay my rent. Call the coincidence. But I knew that I couldn't afford to put all this money out for him to play soccer. But I'm writing it down, but he's not going to do it. And when I hung up the phone, I went through 15 minutes of real selfishness. And I'm grateful that it was only 15 minutes. And I'm grateful that I had an opportunity to do it. Because for 15 minutes, this kid of mine was not going to play soccer, no matter what. And at the end of that 15 minutes, something that it says in the book about us getting out into the mainstream of life occurred to me. And I thought, maybe as a mother, part of the mainstream of life is being responsible to let my son do some of the things that kids like to do. And if he wants to play soccer, then we'll play soccer. And a week ago Wednesday, I was at my very first soccer practice. And that's impossible from where I came from. From where I came from to be out there on that grass with my son with a soccer ball and soccer shoes and shin guards at soccer practice is absolutely impossible. Now, I didn't fit in with the normal soccer mothers. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, people talk about cliques. And what a clique is a group of folks that don't know what else to do after a meeting, so they stand together so it doesn't look like they don't know what else to do after a meeting. And then somebody like me looks and says, well, look it, there's a clique, and there's a clique, and there's a clique. You know, we complain about it, and we make a lot of noise about the cliques. And somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous told me that if I wanted to be in one of those cliques, what I had to do was walk over there and stand amongst those people. And when somebody took a breath, then I started to talk, and then I was in that clique. And it works in Alcoholics Anonymous. So this cunning, powerful, and baffling mind, I figured, will probably work at soccer practice, too. So all the soccer mothers are over here. And so I went strolling on over there. I got right in the middle of them. And I was listening to what they were saying, waiting for them to take a breath. Now, I don't know. You know, they were talking about things like house cleaning and recipes and carpools and church camp. And I thought, dear God, if one of them takes a breath, what am I going to say? Nobody was talking about incomprehensible demoralization. Nobody was talking about vomiting blood. I mean, they weren't talking about the things that I know about. And so I chose. And last Wednesday, it was by my choice. I chose to remove myself from those ladies, and I sat on the grass, and I watched soccer practice for an hour. And Thursday I watched soccer practice, and we've had two soccer practices this week. And if I'm not careful, I might get excited about it the next time I'm out there. From where I came from, that's absolutely impossible. My son should be in a foster home with a mother and a father who care and love for him. My son should be off somewhere with somebody else. You know, by all rights, I shouldn't have him living in my house. And when I get irritated with him, and I do, and when I start yelling at him, and I do, I try to remember that by all rights, you know, he shouldn't be there. By all rights, he should be somewhere else, and it's absolutely impossible for that six-year-old to be living in my house with me, and then I can get grateful for it. I came up here today with, Dick told me that my life would get different, and he was right. Now, sometimes I don't like the difference. sometimes the difference just really annoys me, and then I say, you know, well, sobriety is not very good, it's really bad. And then when the difference makes me happy, then I think sobriety's wonderful, it's the next best thing to pralines and cream ice cream, you know, and it's just, you know, yeah. And I'm not a very good judge of what's good and what's bad. I'm an excellent judge at what's different. And I came up here today, you know, I'm the lady who could not, the best thing that I can tell you to describe what I was like when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is that I was an animal with latent human tendencies. I couldn't stand women and I hated men. Now, that didn't leave me a lot. And that was fine with me. That was absolutely fine with me to be like that. I could not talk to you. I couldn't be with you. I could sit in your meetings and that was all. And when we held hands at the Lord's Prayer, it made me extremely nervous. You know, I wondered what you were going to do to me next. This morning I came up here with a lady that I love and I sat in a car for 5 hours driving up here. I never once had an urgent, overwhelming need to run screaming and yelling from the car. It's probably fortunate since I was driving. I'm comfortable most of the time today doing the things that folks, you know, do. We don't do anything different than anybody else does. You know, I hear a lot of talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about relationships and how horrible we are at them. Well, I think we do just fine. Sometimes good and sometimes bad, always different. You know, I think we do. When I was new, one of my favorite tricks was, and I still do it a lot today, but I did a lot more then, was if you were talking to somebody and you said something that I didn't agree with, I'd jump right in and tell you where you were wrong, what you were saying wrong, what you should say. One evening I overheard a woman telling a newcomer not to get emotionally involved for the first year of her sobriety. No, I jumped right in there. I said, what do you mean telling this lady what to do with her personal life? You don't have any business telling her anything about her personal life. Your business is to tell her how not to drink, quack, 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 quack. And they let me keep going, and when I finally took a breath, this woman says, wait a minute, Pat, wait a minute. She said, you have to remember that you're different. Well, see, I knew that. And she said, I would not give you that kind of information. She said, what I would tell you is not to get emotionally involved with yourself for a year. And anybody else for 5 years. And I didn't understand it. You know, I didn't understand what she was talking about. When my 5th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous was coming up, a friend of mine gave me this 5 that I wear around my neck, and it was getting time to send in for the Bakersfield Convention. Well, I knew God in His infinite wisdom was going to put the person I was going to have an emotional relationship with in bed with me on my 5th AA birthday. I'd wake up and there they'd be, and it'd be too wonderful. And I also knew that God in His infinite wisdom again, my 5th birthday was on a Saturday. And that was going to give us all day Saturday and all day Sunday to get used to each other before we had to go back to work on Monday. I thought, that sounds like what God would do. And I knew that whoever this person was, they were going to want to go to Bakersfield with me to the convention. So I signed up for a double room and I sent in for 2 registrations. One said Patio, Dana Point, and the other one said Unknown. I figured we could fill it in, you know. And on my 5th birthday, when I woke up alone, and I went into the bathroom, I put this 5 on, and I was hanging it around my neck, I started to cry. That was the second time since I'd been sober that I had cried, but I knew what those tears were about. Those tears were about the relationship that I have. The only successful relationship that I have is with a God. And if my relationship with God is right, then my relationship with you is right, at any level. If my relationship with God is not right, then my relationship with you at any level cannot be right. And I knew that morning, and that's what those tears were all about. And my relationship with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has provided me everything I need. It has fulfilled every area in my life, except sexually. You know, this is all I need today. Everything I need is in this meeting. And everything that's in this meeting that I need is directed by a gentle and loving God that I understand. And I cried that morning for that reason, and I was grateful that morning for you people and for this program and for my God. I'd like to end by telling you a story that sums it all up for me. It puts it all together for me, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And it's an old story. It's a story of the man that goes to St. Peter, and they ask St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him to a room, and outside the room's a little card, and it says hell. And they open up the door, and inside that room are tables and tables and tables and tables of food. As much food as you'd ever want, as much as you could ever imagine. The tables were just stacked high with food. And the people that were in that room were dying, and they were starving, and they were hungry. And the reason that they were starving was that they had big wooden spoons tied to their hands. And the spoons were just a little bit too long. They couldn't quite get the spoon to their mouth. And so they sat amongst plenty, and they were dying. And that's how I was when I came to you people. I was sitting amongst plenty, and I was dying. And then St. Peter took him next door to the room marked heaven, and he opened up the door, and inside the room was exactly the same. There were tables and tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, as much as you'd ever want. And the people in that room had those big wooden spoons tied on their hands, too, and they couldn't quite reach their mouth. But the folks in that room were full, and they were content, and they were happy, and they were satisfied. And the difference was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And the man across the table was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding somebody else. And that person was taking some food and feeding somebody else. And that's how it is for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here to get my answers from you. And hopefully every once in a while I can feed somebody else. We started a women's meeting in Laguna Beach for women who don't like women's meetings. It's been overwhelmingly successful. We don't let you knit there. We don't let you talk about your dichondra. And there was a woman that came into that meeting one night, and it had been 2 hours since her last drink. And she walked into that meeting, and she was dying. And she was shaking, and she was sweating, and she was smelling like alcoholic women smell when they walk in here. And she had to keep getting up and going into the bathroom and throwing up. But then she'd come back and sit for a little bit more. And she wanted to be sober more than she wanted to be drunk at that moment. And she stayed for an hour and a half through that meeting. And she went to 2 meetings on Friday and 2 meetings on Saturday. And I had the privilege of taking her to a meeting on Sunday. And we were sitting in a meeting, and there was a woman across the table from my friend, and it was that lady's first day. And that lady was shaking, and she was sweating, and she was dying. And my friend, with 3 days of sobriety, reached across the table and took her hand, and she said, "Honey," she said, "you don't have to be afraid anymore." So we're in a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not sure what's going to happen to us or for us here. She said, "But I believe that if we go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and don't drink, that we won't get drunk. And if we don't get drunk, our life will get different." So you see, you don't have to wait till you're 5 years or 10 years or 20 years sober to start giving this thing away. If you've got one day of sobriety, you have something to give to the person who just walked in. And I'm happy to tell you that both of those ladies are sober today. I heard a man end his pitch one time by saying, "God bless you." When I look around a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I know that you came from the same place that I came from, where alcohol that had been my mother and my father and my God and my lover and my companion and my support and my friend, and then someday that alcohol turned against me and it was the only thing in my life that was trying to kill me. And if alcohol played that part in your life, and you're sitting here today and I'm standing here today and we're sober and we're breathing in and out, then I believe that all of us have already been blessed. Thank you.